All right, thank you, Neil, for the invite. So I'll be talking about how we can detect dark matter substructures in our galaxy using cold stellarimetry. So these are my collaborators, Gianfranco Bertoni, Joe Bovi, and Nassim Bazargnia. So the plan of the talk will be as follows. So I'll start with a brief introduction to the Lambda CDM framework that predicts several substructures inside a host halo. And then, not really sure if I stand. I should stand here, okay. And then I'll introduce what are cold stellar streams and how gaps form in the density of cold stellar streams. And then I'll talk about what do those gaps tell us about the dark matter subhalos that impacted the stream. And then I'll introduce a new approach of studying those gaps. That is, instead of looking at the individual gaps, we will compute the power spectrum of the density of the stream. And then using that, I will present a methodology of distinguishing between cold and warm dark matter. And then finally, I'll talk about the uncertainties that this method has in the form of all the baryonic structures and the effects from them on the stellar streams. So as we all know, this should play. I don't know. Strange. Okay, I'm just going to skip the simulation part. So let's just, I'm not sure why it's not playing here. Okay, so I think everybody knows Lambda CDM framework. What it predicts is that inside a host halo, which contains a Milky Way-sized galaxy, there will be several substructures of dark matter. And so this is a cartoon of that. So, and what this also predicts is that there will be several substructures with mass less than 10 to the 9 solar mass. And those substructures will not have any stars because they are not as massive to initiate star formation, and so they will remain undetected. And so detecting these substructures will be crucial in understanding the particle nature of dark matter and how the dark matter cluster at small scales. So as of now, there are two methods of distinguishing and detecting these substructures. The first one is a gravitational lensing, and the other one is a cold stellar stream. So I'll be focusing on cold stellar streams for the rest of the talk. So this is sad. It's not going to play either. Yeah. Okay. Okay, it's a very sad thing. But anyway, so these cold stellar streams form when globular clusters and dwarf galaxies fall into the gravitational potential of our galaxy. And what happens is they get tidally disrupted. And the stars are ejected from the inner and the outer Lagrange point of these globular clusters or the dwarf galaxies. And they form into tidal tails, which originates from these globular cluster or the dwarf galaxies. And we see several of these streams in the sky, such as the GD1 stream, the Palphi stream, the Sagittarius stream, which originates from the dwarf galaxy Sagittarius. And so the GD1 stream and the Palphi are the globular cluster streams, and so they are very thin because globular clusters are a very cold system and the velocity dispersion is much smaller, like a quarter, a few kilometers per second. Whereas the Sagittarius dwarf is much much more massive, and so it's much the velocity dispersion is much higher, and so the stream width is much wider compared to the cold streams. The orphan stream is, as the name suggests, we don't know the progenitor, so it's just called, an orphan stream. Yeah.
But is the width consistent like the galaxy?
So we actually don't know whether it's a dwarf galaxy or a globular cluster. because it's kind of in the midway between a dwarf galaxy or a globular cluster, so we don't really know anything about it. So these cold stellar streams have a coherent velocity along their length, and their density is also uniform along their length. So the way we can detect these subhalos is when a subhalo flies past a cold stellar stream, and it imparts velocity kicks to the member stars of the stream. And so what happens is then these velocity kicks displaces these stars to different orbits compared to the other stars. And because of this, a local region will have a low stellar density after some time. So okay. So we do see these gaps in real stellar streams. For example, this is the GD1 stream, which was obtained by combining the data from Gaia and Pan-STARRS. And you can see these gaps at different locations. And this is the corresponding underdensities in the stellar stream in the surface density of the stars.
Do these gaps always have like pileups next to them?
They should have. But you know, in some regions, we don't see pileups. For example, here, well, this is not really the density contrast. So you can't really say whether it's a pileup or not. So, but if you plot the density contrast, in some cases you do see pileups, and in some cases you don't. So it kind of depends.
Like the stars that were in the gap went somewhere, right?
So,
like a
so the thing is, so when a stellar stream orbits the galaxy, there's a lot of phase mixing going on within the stars. So even if there is a pileup momentarily after an impact, after a few orbits, they will completely disperse away. So this is the GD1 stream, and so the GD1 stream is a special stream in the sense that the GD1 stream is far away from the galactic center and the disk, and so what this means is that all the perturbations that we see could be attributed to dark matter subhalo impacts, because all the substructures, all the baryonic substructures are confined to the disk and close to the center of the galaxy. So this is a promising stream that we should be looking at. So what can the gaps tell us about the dark matter subhalo? So if you just look at the individual gap size, it tells quite a lot of information. For example, here, in this analysis done by Erkal and Belokurov, they were able to constrain several of the encounter parameters, such as the scale length of the subhalo, the impact parameter, and the time of impact. But there's a strong degeneracy between the mass of the subhalo and the velocity of flyby. Yeah?
Here you assume one subhalo?
Yes, this is only for one subhalo.
So how do you know it could not be like more, two or three?
This is just like a toy model, just to demonstrate that we can extract the information of the impacting subhalo. But in the later slides, I'll show that I have impacted a stream in all possible subhalos. Right. So this degeneracy is then a problem in the sense that we can't really tell the mass of the impacting subhalo and the velocity of the flyby. And this is also demonstrated in this density contrast plot. So here is the same size gap, but they are created by three different impacts. So the blue line is the fiducial in which it was impacted by one subhalo with scale radius of 250 parsec and flying past at 100 kilometers per second perpendicular to the stream. It created a higher density contrast, but the size of the gap is still around 8 degrees. And the same gap size can be created by the same subhalo flying past at a slower speed, resulting in a lower density contrast, but the size of the gap is still the same. And so this demonstrates the degeneracy between the mass of the subhalo and the velocity of flyby.
But you could use a density contrast to distinguish them.
But it's really hard to compute the density contrast to distinguish it because until now, and we have Gaia. So, but also, if you just look at the density contrast, it's also hard. I did not show this, but if you just have the density contrast, it's still hard because you can create the same density contrast by a massive subhalo flying past at a slower velocity versus a less massive subhalo flying past at a much slower velocity. Because the time of flyby is very crucial. If it's flying past the stream at a much at a much lower velocity, then the time it gets to perturb the member stars is much higher. And so the density contrast can be obtained, which is similar to a more massive subhalo flyby.
But I mean, there's still two independent things that you measure, the size of the gap and the density contrast. I mean, here, for example, you see the size of the gap doesn't change, but the density contrast does change. So, you get extra information if you could model it, I'm not sure. So why can't you measure the contrast? It seems to me, if you can measure the gap, you can measure the contrast.
So you can measure the density contrast, but then there is still the degeneracy in the mass and the velocity of the flyby.
Well, the size is a degeneracy. This point, I guess, is that in your plot. Mm-hmm. It's a delta rho over rho, I mean, it seems to distinguish. But in practice, I guess, right, so you have like background stars that are hard to distinguish from the actual stream stars. And that background, I guess, then makes it hard to actually measure the contrast as opposed to like just like the size of the gap.
It seems to me that equally different. If you cannot see the stream, then you cannot see the stream. If you can't see the stream, so that you can identify
it. So if I add some background to the blue curve, the size hasn't changed of that gap, but its contrast has changed a lot. Right.
I mean, if it's just a constant shift up and down, your contrast can also be same because it's just the maximum and the minimum.
It's not going to be a constant background, though. It will depend on the angle, too, right? Because. So a better method to look at the stream density is then to compute the density power spectrum of several thousands of realizations. So what this does effectively is to marginalize over the parameter which you're not really interested. For example, here in this case, it's sort of marginalizing over all the possible velocities of subhalo flyby. So here, what we're doing is, so the stream had a single impact by a subhalo of, several different masses. And then, so these people ran like thousands of simulations by sampling the subhalo velocities from all possible subhalo velocity distribution. And the plot here shows the median of the power spectrum of all these different realizations of the simulations. So here, there is a clear distinction between different mass subhalo impacts. For example, if the stream had an impact by a small mass subhalo, there is more power at smaller scale compared to at higher scale. This can be explained by if a subhalo is smaller, then it imparts velocity, then it imparts density perturbation at smaller angular scales. And you can do the same thing for the track of the stream and the cross correlation between the track and the density of the stream, and you also see the same trend. So as you increase the mass of the subhalo, there's more power at a larger angular scale.
So what's omega, sorry?
Omega is the track of the stream. So if you have the stream in the sky, so you have two angular scales like, like phi1, phi2. So you can compute the track of the stream of that. And then, so if it's
So should I think of omega as like a vertical displacement perpendicular to the stream? Is that what that means, or no?
So in the sky coordinates, you can have omega to be anything, actually. So it could either be the two angles which describe the track of the stream. It could also be the velocity to the line of sight. This is just, so in this case, omega is just the frequency of the stars, which defines the track here. But if you convert that track to physical coordinates, it could be either velocity to the line of sight or the distance to the stars.
Okay. But here, you're making something like that angle.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Whereas delta is like a one-dimensional
density.
So you're not using, you know, so like the transverse displacements.
In this, no, no. Yeah.
So that's small compared to the displacements along the.
Yeah, it, yeah, okay. It's much smaller. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So in this method, you have to run several thousands of simulations of the subhalo impacting the stream. And so it can be done in n-body simulations because it will take a long time to run such a large number of simulations. So one way out is to do the simulations in the frequency angle space in which the stream, a cold stream, looks like a one-dimensional line. And so it's very easy to model these frequency angle and the evolution of the stream in the frequency angle space. And the evolution equation is also extremely simple, in which the frequency remains a constant and the angle changes in a linear way. So instead of solving the Hamilton's equation in the physical coordinates, if you go to the frequency angle space, then you know the equations are very simple to model and evolve. So using this, we simulated the GD1 stream, and this sort of matches the observed GD1 stream from the SDSS. This is from Kaposov and others, and these A line and the blue line shows this simulated GD1 stream. So this is reassuring that we're able to generate the observed stream in the sky using the frequency angle framework.
Is there an offset or something?
Yeah, there is a little bit of offset because the location of the progenitor was set by the by a different set of conditions than the SDSS, so that's why there is a little bit of offset. This is just to show that we're able to get the same sky coordinates, but we can do much better than this. So the impacts by the subhalos can also be modeled in these frequency angle framework. So what the impacts do is that they impart velocity kicks. And those velocity kicks can be transformed into frequency kicks and angle kicks at a particular time. And if you add those, then these equations can be evolved in the same way as we did in the previous case. And then it will just transform into the gaps or the density perturbations. So just to show that this method works, so here is a comparison plot between the n-body code, which is shown by the blue lines and the error bars, and then the model in the frequency angle framework. So in both cases, the stream had 24 subhalo impacts between 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 8 solar mass, and they created the same visible gaps as we can see here. The only difference is that in the n-body code, the simulation run like 3 hours to run, and the frequency angle framework, it took only 2 minutes to run. So it accelerates the ability to run such simulations if we go to the frequency angle framework.
What's the approximation that we made? The approximation just is that these are impulses as opposed to actual, like, dynamical flybys?
Yeah, yeah.
Something more than that.
I think there is something more than that, because even in the n-body code, you do take the impacts are almost like impulse kicks. But yeah.
So why did these two like not match exactly, I guess, is my question. Because all I've done here just is some like transformation coordinates going from
So it's not exactly the transformation of coordinates, because it also depends on so if you look at what's exactly happening is we only consider the kicks that is along the stream instead of looking at the kick, which is, yeah, in, yeah. And it can be shown that if you just take those kicks, then those are the substantial amount of perturbations that can be imparted to the density. And that's why, you know, this, you know, there is a slight offset. So, okay, so then, so we have the framework to do the simulations. Now we need a prescription of incorporating different models of dark matter. So just to show this, you know, quickly, I'll just go over these basic slides. So you have, in the CDM framework, you have several more substructures compared to in the warm dark matter framework because of the velocity dispersion in warm dark matter washing out substructures below a certain scale. So to model these different kinds of dark matter into our simulations, what we did was we took the power spectrum of the, so we only consider a thermal relic, and it can be generalized to sterile neutrinos by including the lepton asymmetry parameter, but in this work, we only have considered the thermal relic where the power spectrum of the warm dark matter depends only on the mass of the warm dark matter particle. So the way this is modeled is by introducing a transfer function which depends on this alpha parameter, which depends inversely as the mass of the warm dark matter particle. So as you increase the mass of the warm dark matter particle, it gets closer and closer to the CDM case. And as you decrease them, then you know there is a cutoff below which the structure formations are suppressed. Okay, so then to introduce this model into our simulation, we need the sub-Hilo mass function. So for the cold dark matter case, we took the sub-Hilo mass function from the Aquarius simulation, and then they also found that the distribution of these sub-Hilos follows an Einaster profile. So that's the Einaster profile here. And then for the warm dark matter case, Bubble and others found that the cold dark matter case sub-Hilo mass function can be modified to act as the, you know, in the warm dark matter case by multiplying by this factor, which includes this half mode mass, which sort of gives us the mass below which structures are suppressed. So this is the sub-Hilo mass function for the warm dark matter case that we incorporate in our simulations. Also, there will be disruption of these subhalos by baryonic effects of the disk and other structures. And Sawala and others found that around 45 to 50% of these subhalos will be disrupted within the galactocentric radius of GD1 and PAL5, independent of their mass. And so we just reduced the amount of substructures by a constant amount of 53%, just to check what will be the effects. And so this plot shows the number of substructures within the galactocentric radius of 23 kiloparsec for different mass of dark matter. So in the warm dark matter case, there is the abundance is a lot less than in the cold dark matter case.
So might the spectrum depend on some astrophysical distance parameters like
GMO, star formation? Yeah. So they took all kinds of baryonic effects into account, including star formation, stellar feedback, and all these things. So, yeah.
Does this disruption depend on the mass of the sub-halo? Because I would expect more mass of sub-halo.
So in that work, they found that it is independent of the mass of the sub-halo. Okay, so we have the ingredients now to do this kind of study. So the main idea depends on the fact that in the CDM case, there are several more subhalos compared to the warm dark matter case. And so if a stream is evolved in the CDM universe, it will have much more density perturbations compared to in the warm dark matter case. And as a result, we should be able to tell it apart by computing the power spectrum of these two cases. And so that's what we did. We evolved the stream in a 5 kV warm dark matter universe for thousands of different realizations. I'm just showing four of those here. And in the same way, in the 1 GeV cold dark matter universe, yeah.
In different realizations, you have the same exact smooth initial density of the stream as it starts?
Yeah. It's the same initial smooth stream, and then you evolve it in the Yeah.
How large could be the fluctuations in this stream be? Maybe, I don't know, the stream could have already some small gaps here and there, by chance.
The stream
should be small. I mean, you're assuming that it is exactly homogeneous, right, the initial stream.
Yeah, the initial, so the smooth stream is always, like, always smooth. There, so.
And we see it from the other streams, I mean, from the average of the streams.
So this is a model, and we just assume that initially this, you know, the stream is absolutely smooth. There is no initial perturbations to the, you know, to the stream, but this can, you know, this could change because there could be other factors, like inside the globular cluster from which the stream emerged, there could be substructures inside, you know, the, you know, like stellar structures inside the globular cluster, which we don't know, yeah, which we haven't considered in this work. So we just assume it's initially completely smooth, and then, you know, it's evolving these subhalos, and these are the impacts that we get. Yeah.
How could we test this hypothesis?
So for that, you really have to go into the details of how the stars are stripped from the globular clusters, and for that, you have to run a full n-body code and to actually investigate how the stars are actually stripped. We haven't really done this, but I'm actually looking into doing it. Because it's really hard to tell anything about these globular clusters and how they, you know, how they eject these stars. Because the only globular cluster which we still see is still ejecting stars is the PAL 5, and so you can test it. But also, as I'll show, the PAL 5 is heavily perturbed by the other baryonic structures in our galaxy, so it's kind of also hard to tell. So,
most of the stripping is happening at perisenter of the orbit, right?
So most of the stripping is happening at perisenter, but there is still some stripping at other phases of the orbit. But most of it is happening, yeah.
The stripping rate is not uniform, right?
In time, in these simulations, it's uniform.
Right, but in reality, I'm saying.
No, it's not. No.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're right. I think that therefore there should be the like density.
Yeah. So those are called the And there could also be epicyclic, you know, hyla, but as can be seen in these simulations, they don't really matter much because most of the epicyclic hyla will be close to the progenitor, and after a few orbits, there will be phase mixing, and you know, those will disperse away. So on these density density contrast, the first difference we can see between the warm dark matter and the cold dark matter case is that in the cold dark matter case, you see several small-scale perturbations, for example, here, which are absent in the warm dark matter case. And this makes sense because in the cold dark matter case, you have subhalos all the way down to like 10 to the 5 solar mass and so. Whereas in the 5 KV case, you only get subhalos at least of like 10 to the 7 solar mass or so. And also, because the abundance of substructures is much lower in the 5 KV case, there could be cases in which the stream does not encounter any subhalos at all. And so the density contrast is just equal to 1 everywhere. OK, so then we computed the power spectrum of these densities of 2100 simulations for each case. And this plot shows the median power for all those cases. So here you can clearly see there is a difference in the power for the warm dark matter case versus a cold dark matter case. And as you increase the mass of the warm dark matter, it gets closer and closer to the cold dark matter. And so the power spectrum gets closer and closer to the cold dark matter. And beyond, say, 17 kV or so, there is no way to tell it apart from the cold dark matter because 17 kV is really cold. Yeah.
So you have an ensemble where, because there are fewer encounters, the lower the temperature, that's the thing that's bringing the normalization down power. Is that?
So if you have a lower mass, then it's more warm dark matter, right?
I'm just saying, like, the normalization is just due to the fact that you have the possibility of no encounters.
So the normalization is done for each individual case, depending on the.
So you have a median power spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe another way of asking my question is, do you include in the computation of that power spectrum the cases where you have no encounters?
Yes, yes, yes.
And is that the reason why the normalization is lower?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So to make a real comparison, like you need an ensemble of observed streams to get the normalization of
In real life, if you have a warm dark matter, then there will be fewer subhalos, right? So you should get a few realizations in which the stream does not encounter any subhalos. So I think those cases in which it's just a flat horizontal line is a realistic case. So we shouldn't just pull them out. Is that what you're asking?
I guess just because the shape of all these power spectra are pretty identical, it's just the normalization that you're trying to fix. So basically, the observable is how many streams don't have structure versus how many streams do. Is that right or no?
I think I think the thing that's that we should see is that the power is lower in the warm dark matter case because it had fewer impacts than in the
previous slide, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, here, right? So here you were showing that in the colder case, mm-hmm. more small scale structure.
Yeah,
yeah. So then the power spectrum, that fact should show up as like a scale dependence in the suppression, right?
So in this case, you can see that for the cold dark matter case, there is more power at smaller scale than in the warm dark matter case.
And that's what I think, is that as you make the dark matter warmer and warmer, mm-hmm. The effect just seems to be an overall normalization shift in the power spectrum, as opposed to like a tilting of the power spectrum, which is just surprising given your previous slide.
So
if you extended this, further to smaller scales, would
yeah,
you start
yeah.
seeing shape dependence?
So if you compute the median power, I don't think there is much of a shape dependence here. I mean, unless you have a lot of noise or something. I don't know. Like, if you have noise that is dependent.
There's some scale below which there are like zero subhalos below some mass scale, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so then I would think then that there's some length scale below which the streams are just coherent because there's no small scale perturbations anymore.
But then even in those cases, you could have subhalo impact. So these are in, as a function of the angle along the length of the stream. And because each stream is having several different subhalo impacts, even if an impact happens at a different angle, after phase mixing, those perturbations can move. So is that?
Like some movies might have helped, but
yeah.
So it seems that it's more the number of subhalos that matter rather than their size. So I guess their size would be the thing that you're thinking about.
Yeah.
If you have one dark matter, then would be more puffy.
That's
but true. I think that maybe they're just too small, just the number that's the control.
The size has has some observable effect, but it's not much. Compared to the number of impacts, though, yes. So then, as you keep increasing the mass, it gets closer to the cold dark matter case. And this sort of, this can be understood again by this plot, where you, as you increase the mass, it gets closer to the cold dark matter power spectrum. So this can be used to distinguish between cold dark matter and warm dark matter. And so that's what we did. So we used the approximate Bayesian computation approach to obtain the posterior PDF on the mass of dark matter. So it's a likelihood-free approach, and it works as follows. So if you have some data, you define some tolerance around that data, and then you run several thousands of simulations over a prior. In this case, our prior was the mass of the warm dark matter between 0 to 17 kV, because beyond 17 kV, there is no way to tell it apart from the cold dark matter case. And then for those simulations whose power was within the tolerance, we accept those simulations. And for those which are not within the tolerance, we reject them. And from the simulations that were accepted, from those simulations, we construct the posterior. And so this is the posterior that we get for the 5 kV case, and this is for the 1 GV case. So in the warm dark matter case, if the mass of the warm dark matter is a few kV, then this method can constrain the mass. And there's a clear distinction between the PDF, between the warm and the cold dark matter. And the cold dark matter case, the PDF sort of plateaus at higher mass of the dark matter particle, showing that the true mass is beyond the range of the prior. So this all looks very promising, but this is not the entire picture, because this is, you know, we shouldn't overinterpret this result, because there's only two sigma, and it's only for one stellar stream. And this can be highlighted by the dispersion of the power that you get for different mass of the dark matter particle. So in this case, I'm showing you 3.3 kV warm dark matter, the 5 kV and the 1 GV. So in the 3.3 kV case, so in each plot, the error bars show the 2 sigma dispersion of the power. And the black solid line is the median of the power of all these different realizations. So in the 3.3 kV case, there is no median which is above this line, because the median is all the way to zero, because in the 3.3 kV case, there are very few subhalos. And so in most of the cases, the stream did not have any impacts. In the 5 kV case, the median is lower than the 1 GV case, as expected. And so the thing that I'm trying to highlight here is that if you end up with a realization which is 2 sigma off from the median, you would end up inferring the mass of the dark matter 2 sigma off wrong. So what we did was we picked this upper 2 sigma realization in the 3.3 kV case, in the 5 kV case, and then in the 1 GV case, we picked a lower 2 sigma case. And then if we run the ABC machine in the 3.3 kV and the 5 kV case, we get 2 sigma off results, which is predicting that the dark matter is cold. But in the 1 GV case, as we pegged a 2 sigma lower bound, it predicts in a very wrong way that the dark matter is warm. So the way out is to combine multiple stream statistics to get a robust estimate on these inference. And we can do this in the current time, because now we have data from DES and Gaia, and also several streams we discovered with the LSST. So this is something very interesting, and I'm currently working on combining several stream statistics to make a more robust estimate on the mass of dark matter.
I want to understand what's going on. So can I summarize the method as follows? So you have some, for some theory of substructure, your different masses for the dark matter particle, you have some median ensemble average power spectrum of all these streams that have undergone different numbers of interactions,
right,
and so on and so forth. And so within that model, you have one stream, and you're basically trying to say how discrepant is that one stream from the ensemble average power spectrum, and that's how you're going to judge the likelihood, it's a likelihood function. But if I could say that, that's kind of...
Generally
speaking, what you're doing?
Yeah.
I guess, it seems to me that with a single stream, you just have a really, and maybe you're showing us this, have a really hard time inferring anything. It's like having variance or something. How do you tell with one stream and how discrepant that really is? Discrepant from the ensemble.
So with just one stream, you can't really tell. So that's what I'm trying to show, that if you are, if you end up with a stream which is very close to the median of all these possible realizations that you have, then you would get a good prediction, but only at around 2 sigma or so are so level.
I guess I'm just saying, like, it seems pretty likely that if I just have one stream, that by accident I might just happen to fall on the ensemble average curve or something.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why you need more streams. You can't really, you know, do any meaningful prediction with this with just one stream. Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
But your analysis ultimately will use like the full likelihood of the power spectrum for your time, right?
So in this, so we don't really use the likelihood. We just use the power. I did not talk about this, but this is the noise power that we also should be careful about, because the, so in this case, the 10% noise is the LSST like noise that we use, which is the Schott noise in each of the bins that we are using to bin the number of stars. And so all those power at scales which are above the noise will be able to distinguish between models of dark matter. And so in this case, we only take those power which are above the noise floor in each of these cases. So for example, in this case, we only take the power at the largest three scales to compare different models of dark matter.
So is the power spectrum like the optimal way of doing this? I mean, you know, because your gaps seem pretty like non-Gaussian, right?
So there are some problems with modeling the gaps too, because...
Well, not problems, I'm just wondering if there's like more information on the table being left behind, you know?
Well,
like a power spectrum.
Yeah, yeah. So statistically, in the power spectrum method, you are not really throwing out any information. We are considering all possible, I mean, even the smallest density perturbations along the gap is being considered, whereas in the gap method, you only look at a single gap in a stream and try to infer the properties of dark matter. So statistically, I think this is much more robust than the gap. But still, if you're just doing it for one stream, I think it's not the complete picture.
Yeah, but I think Neil's point is you're using all, but they're using some information, but there's still, I guess, a higher order Kardashian function, right? Because power spectrum is just 2-point Kardashian function.
Yeah, there, so, yeah, exactly, yeah, yeah. So I did not show this, but we can also compute the bispectrum, and they have the same feature as the power spectrum, and you can also use the bispectrum to distinguish between models of dark matter. But we did not do it in this case, but yeah. Yeah, you can use higher point statistics too. Okay,
Some institutions are in the, like, integrating the electrons. The confidence regions that are referred to is like, so those came by integrating and keeping like the 95% quantile.
Yeah, so we accept all those simulations which are within the tolerance that we defined along.
I mean, like in the, to take the middle plot, it looks like the likelihood just keeps climbing up to high mass, which I guess means this realization is, you know, it might even be consistent with infinite mass, i.e. cold dark matter.
So
95% region that you assign be very dependent on the choice of the cloud.
So I guess if you continue several more realizations above 17 kV, this would appear to flatten off at a higher mass. But
this number of 6 kV, does that depend on where you choose to cut the plot off?
So we didn't really cut the plot off. We just took the prior all up to 17 kV. So there are no points.
To phrase the question differently, does it depend on where you cut off the prior?
So we just chose the prior to cut off at 17 kV because beyond 17 kV, there was no way to distinguish between cold and warm.
Does that mean that if I had chosen 27 instead of 17?
Yeah.
Would I get a different number for like 6 kV?
So in principle, you shouldn't. But then we only did because we only went up to 17. So if you choose the prior to be like up to 27, then yes, these numbers will change. Yeah. But if you do like several, this is from 500,000 simulations. if you increase that number to even higher, then maybe you should like, you know, you should get a much more consistent picture.
The shape of the prior array also, I guess, will affect this number, right? If you just assume, like, a flat.
Yeah, it's just a flat prior that we have taken. Yeah, yeah.
Similarly, I mean, you could also choose like a log prior.
Absolutely. Prior, yes. Like, yes. Also, yeah. Also, the ABC that we use is like the most basic ABC. We just accept and reject. But there are much more fancier ABC where you know, apply weights depending on how far you are from the tolerance region. So yeah, but this is just to show that we can distinguish it, you know, if you use this method. Yeah. So yeah, so now I'll talk about some of the baryonic structures and their uncertainties on the stellar streams. So in particular, I'll focus on their effects on the PAL-5 stream because it is one of the most well-studied stream. And it also suffers a lot of perturbations from all these structures. So this is the orbit of the PAL-5 stream. This is the present location, and it goes through the disk several times in the past. And so it is highly likely that it was perturbed by the GMCs, the bar, and the spiral arms, and the globular clusters. So, so we'll talk about these four substructures of our galaxy, the baryonic structures of our galaxy which can affect the PAL-5 stream. So here we have the bar. We have the spiral arms, so we don't really know if there are two or four spiral arms, so we tested for both two and four. And then we took the entire population of the GMCs, which contains 8,000 or so GMCs, and then we also have the entire population of the globular clusters. So to start off with the bar, so we use this triaxial exponential density profile for the bar, which is which was obtained by observation of the bar. And so to get the density, to get the potential from the density of this bar, we use the basis function expansion method. And so as you increase the expansion order, you get closer and closer to the analytic form. But because we have computational limitations, so we only went up to n equals 9 and l equals 19. And this gave us a very good reconstruction of the density of the analytic form. The departure of the density beyond 5 keV in these cases don't really matter, because beyond 5 keV, the density due to the halo and the disk overpowers the density of the bar. So for these kinds of simulations that we're going to run, this gives a very good reconstruction of the density of the bar. So we place this bar in the Milky Way center, and we assign some pattern speed to it. So in this case, I'm showing the smooth stream in the absence of a bar that was evolved for 5 giga years. And then in the presence of the bar, this is the density of the stream. And then we normalize it with this polynomial fit to get the density contrast of the stream. So one interesting thing that we found in the study of the effects of the bar is that for different mass and pattern speeds, the length of the stream is shortened by a lot. So we see the trailing arm of the PAL-5 stream to be of order 14 degrees or so in the sky. And so for different mass and pattern speed, we tested the length of these of the trailing arm of the PAL-5 stream. And for certain values, such as 35, 45, and 55, the length of the stream is shortened by a lot. And this is due to the resonance between the bar and the progenitor. And this happens, and it has been seen in actual in-body simulations, in which if the progenitor is in resonance with the bar, then the stream that ejects from the progenitor is highly perturbed. And it can also reduce the length of the ejected stream. So this could, in principle, be used to constrain the pattern speed of the bar, because we don't really know what is the pattern speed of the bar. But this is something that we haven't really done, and we're currently investigating that. So we also tested what is the effect of the progenitor's orbit on the stream density. So this is the orbit of the PAL-5 over the 5 giga years. In the presence of the bar, which is shown by the red curve, and without the bar, which is shown by the black curve, and there is a very minute difference between the orbit, but nonetheless, there is some difference, and we just tested this by evolving the stream in the presence of the progenitor let loose, and then subtracting the difference from the case in which the progenitor was held fixed. And we just present this difference to show if there is any big difference in the progenitor's orbit. So these are the results for the bar. So this is for the for different values of pattern speed, for different mass of the bar, and different age of the bar. So in these top panels, I'm showing the power spectrum for different values of the pattern speed, the mass, and the age. In the sub panel, I'm showing the difference in the power in the case in which the progenitor was allowed to move, and minus the case in which the progenitor was not allowed to move. So a negative power would imply that if you allow the progenitor to move, there is lower power overall. So in the so if you change the pattern speed again, you see that for certain pattern speeds, the power is more compared to the other pattern speeds, and there are no trends in the pattern speeds. And so this, again, indicates there could be some kind of resonance between the bar and the progenitor. And also, overplotted is this cyan line, which shows the power spectrum in the CDM subhalo case, in which the stream only was impacted by CDM subhalos. And so as far as comparing the power spectrum goes, there is, you know, you can produce power in the stream density just by the presence of a bar, which can account for all the power due to the CDM subhalos. And this is, again, for the case of the mass, and there is a clear trend. As you increase the mass, the power increases. And for the age, as long as the bar is older than 1 giga year, the power doesn't really change much. Okay, so the next thing is the spiral arms. We tested for both 2 and 4 spiral arms. I'm only showing for the 4 because for 2, the power was consistently lower than this. And again, in this case, you can explain or account for all the power that a stream will have due to subhalo impacts, like whole dark matter subhalo impacts. We also tested for different pattern speeds of the spiral arms. And so this is, again, this is another potential perturbers for the PALFI stream. And so we took the entire catalog of GMCs, we set them into their orbits, we integrated them back for 5 giga years, and then we integrated them forward in the presence of the stream for 5 giga years until today. And then we computed the density contrast and hence the power spectrum of the stream. So one thing that we took care of the GMCs is that the GMCs appear and disappear every 10 to 50 million years, because as stars form, the stellar feedback can diffuse the GMCs, and then that GMC is gone. So they live over a timescale of order 10 to 50 million years. So to account for this, we took the coordinates of the GMCs and we added random phase rotations to their coordinates. And then we ran several different realizations by adding these random phi rotations. So that way, we are ensuring that the mass function of the GMC is conserved, but their location is changed by these phi rotations. So combining this, we obtain this power spectrum in the case of the GMC and the 2-sigma dispersion. Here, you can see there is a clear, very high power at small scale, which is indicated by these two different realizations I'm showing. So if you compare this back in the, if you compare this density with the subhalo impacts, you can see there are several small scale structures. And this is because for a given mass, the GMC is like 5 times more compact than the subhalos. And so they are capable of inflicting very small scale perturbation to the stream. This is also shown by a very high power at smaller angular scale. So we also tested if you change the orbit of the PAL5, how that will be affected by the GMCs. So within observational constraints, you know, there is a bit of a wiggle room in which you can change the orbit, and that will result in the pericenter of the stream to vary between 4.68 to 7.92 kiloparsec. So the result is that if you change the pericenter, then on an average, the stream suffers several more EMC impacts compared to the fiducial case. And so all these cases are summarized in this plot. The black line is for the fiducial case. The gray region shows a 2-sigma dispersion of several different phi random rotations of the GMCs, and compared with the CDM case, in which, again, you know, if you just have the GMCs, you can explain or account for all the power due to the CDM subhalos. And there is a lot of dispersion in this case, and this is because we don't know how the GMCs evolved over the dynamical age of the stream. So this is, you know, sort of our ignorance, which is being, you know, quantified by this dispersion. And then finally, we took the globular clusters. So we have around 157 globular clusters in our galaxy. We took their phase space information from Fazilyev and Elmi's paper, which are based on Gaia data release. And then the masses were taken from this catalog. So the mass catalog did not have all the masses. So what we did was, to be more conservative, the missing masses were replaced by the highest mass of the GCs that we had. And so that's why there is this line. So this is a very conservative limit on where we're going to put. And so we impacted them to the stream. And there is barely any power in the stream. And you know, this can be understood by the fact that the globular clusters are very tiny objects and very low mass objects. So there is no power in the PAL5 stream. So this is the summary plot of all these of these structures, and so the main conclusion is that PAL5 can be severely perturbed by the bar, the spiral arms, and the GMCs, and I'm also showing the actual power of the PAL5 that was from the observed data from Ibarra and others. And so you can see that individually, you can account for all the power that we observe for PAL5.
What about the small scales? It looks like the curves are below the points.
So the gray line is the noise in the power. And so as far as this analysis is concerned, all the codes that we developed can be easily adapted for any other stellar streams and show, so should be a very important.
It seems that then all the points are basically consistent with noise, I don't know, I guess.
So except for the these two scales, all these points are consistent with the noise, and hence we don't, so when it comes to distinguishing between models of dark matter, we only use these top two scales because those are the scales which are above the noise floor. So all these points will not be able to distinguish between models of dark matter.
So I mean, if you go to large angles, there are like very few modes that you have. So
yeah.
there is uncertainty even in noise. So you wouldn't. So I guess I'm trying to figure out is how much really actually significant there is in power at large angles. So that basically was like that gray curve that actually has uncertainty that gets bigger as you go to larger angles.
So this noise is just the Gaussian noise and the shot noise.
Right, but basically you have fewer and fewer modes at larger and larger angles and smaller caves.
Yes, yeah.
So that means that
so your points have larger bars, right?
That's right.
The point shot noise is just
But so the mean of the shot noise and there's the variance of the shot noise. And then the fewer modes you have, the larger is the variance of the shot. The same way that the CMB, that the cosmic variance goes up at a small
the same with the measurements. Okay, we'll discuss this later. This is a 1D power spectrum, so it doesn't have to go on a gravel. It's part of the log scale, so.
But I guess the question is, how have you been the host? Yeah, I guess I don't know.
So
anyway, so that's the, I guess it's a fine. It's a technical point.
Other prospects, you know, to reduce background noise?
Yeah, with Gaia, we expect to decrease the noise, but we haven't really done it yet. People haven't really, you know, cleaned up the Gaia data for the PAL 5 yet. So, yeah.
Any guess as to how much it might be reduced?
It shouldn't go too much lower than what we already have, because Gaia only goes to magnitude like G20 or something. So with LSST, probably yes. But yeah, with Gaia, not much. So yeah, so in conclusion then, stellar streams are an excellent probe for detecting substructures in our galaxy. And using a statistical method of computing the power spectrum, we can distinguish between models of dark matter. And by combining several stream statistics, we should be able to get some robust estimate on the dark matter model that we have. And then detecting these subhalos will be crucial in understanding the particle nature and how these substructures clump at smaller scales. And the baryonic structures can severely perturb a stellar stream and should be taken into account for any such analysis that we're going to do. Right.
Seems like the GMCs are a significant bias in the power spectrum.
Yes.
So do I need to know all the GMCs in the galaxy in order to then place constraints on?
Yes. So it's not. Yeah. So it's not just the location of the GMCs that we see, because the GMC that we see today did not exist like in a giga year back, because you know the age of the GMC is like 10 to 50 million years. So yeah, there is always going to be a lot of uncertainty when you're combining the GMC power. The only way out is to pick a stream which is much more farther away from the galactic disk, because the GMCs are all confined to the disk. So GD1 is one such stream, which is much farther away from all these GMCs. So yeah.
So with Gaia, we will have proper motion probably also of the stream. Are there thoughts of including that information somehow into the models?
So if you just have proper motions, you still need a color magnitude cut to actually extract the stream. Because if you just apply the proper motion cut, there will still be a lot of background and foreground stars included in that proper motion cut. So for example, in this plot that... Here they combined the proper motion from Gaia, and then they took the color magnitude information from the pan stars, and then they cross matched them to get this clean stream. Because if you just get either the color magnitude cut, you still have a lot of foreground and background stars. So.
Right, but then also about the dynamics, like the motion of the stream that can be used to constrain the model of your.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah. Yes.
Any more questions?
So I forgot to say at the beginning of the talk that we'll do a speaker dinner at 6 p.m. in the first show. That wasn't a question.